And as Kali Yuga progresses also, it goes further down and down and down and down. And by the time the end of Kali comes, then it is a catastrophic situation. In the previous ages, people are very tall, very big, and they come, get shorter and shorter and shorter. And by the time Kali Yuga ends, someone who is 4 feet tall will be considered a giant. So therefore, because the memory power, the intelligence, the capacity to understand and grasp philosophical ideas, even the inclination for philosophical ideas, it diminishes in Kali Yuga. So we need something in written format. In the earlier ages, there was no need to write down anything. The students used to go to the Gurukul, and just by repeating the messages or the teachings of the Guru, the mantras and other teachings, they would remember it. There was no need to write down anything on paper. So sharp were their brains, their minds, intelligence, memory, etc. And this continued for all the three ages. However, when the end of Dwapar Yuga approached, Vyasadeva, whose name is Krishna Dvaipayana actually, he began to consider what would be the situation in Kali Yuga. Vyasadeva is a post, it's a title. And different personalities at different yugas, they get this post, just like Prime Minister, it's a post. And different individuals at different times get that post. So the individual, the person who is now the Vyasadeva or the Veda Vyas is called Krishna Dvaipayana. Krishna here refers to dark because he was dark complexioned, and Dvaipayana referring to his birth on an island. So he was the son of a great sage called Parashar Muni. And his mother was Satyavati, who eventually went to Hastinapur. And those of you who have read the Mahabharata, you have heard the name of Satyavati. So Vyasadeva, he understood that the situation was very bleak in Kali Yuga. And therefore he reckoned that the Vedic teachings have to be put down in writing. The word Veda means knowledge. And in the early days, since there was nothing in written form, everything, all forms of knowledge were part of Veda. The highest spiritual knowledge, right down to even other forms of material knowledge which were necessary for human survival. For example, in the Vedic literature, you have many types of scriptures. You have scriptures dealing with architecture, construction. They were called the Sthapatya Veda. You had scriptures dealing with music, with grammar and language, with martial arts, you know, art of warfare. And there were so many other things, including medical science, Ayurveda, Dhanurveda. Yes, so many different branches of knowledge. So some branches are called Upaveda. They are secondary, subsidiary knowledge. And there was other knowledge which was very important, which was completely spiritual knowledge. So for that you had other types of books, or knowledge rather, books came later, like the Upanishads. So this knowledge was one knowledge. So Veda means knowledge, the sum total of all knowledge that originates from the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. So now Veda Vyas, he began to consider, what shall I do to make this knowledge of Veda available to the people in the next age of Kali? It's a huge task. The knowledge is so vast. How can I just put it in a succinct form? So then he applied his vast intelligence. And then he divided the original knowledge of the Veda into four. Rig, Sam, Atharva, Yajur. So four Vedas were formed. Before that there was only one Veda. And then along with each Veda, there were many other subsidiary texts. There were Puranas, there were Upanishads, there were other forms of scriptures. So Vyasadeva wrote all these scriptures, or he had to. He visualized, I will have to write down all these things, because in Kali Yuga, this oral reception, just speaking and hearing and remembering, is not going to work. So he composed them and then he dictated them, and that is how the whole Vedic literature became written and came to us. So it is a stupendous task that Vyasadeva has done. He has made all knowledge available. Just to give you a hint or understanding of how big the task was, suppose that all our textbooks and books of knowledge in schools, college, university were all lost. And someone had to write all the books all over again, whether it's accounting, engineering, medicine, surgery, economics, language, music, everything. Just imagine how big the task would be. And this knowledge is a very small fraction of the entire Vedic knowledge, because today's knowledge doesn't include spiritual knowledge, which constitutes a very vast proportion of the entirety of knowledge. So we can only imagine how intelligent and brilliant Vyasadeva was, or rather I should say is, because he's one of the Chiranjeevis, long living people. Along with many other personalities as given in the scriptures, he's still alive today. But we cannot see him because he doesn't want to make himself visible to us, because we are not qualified to see him. So he has compiled the Vedas, divided into different categories, and made it readily accessible for the people of this age. Then he handed over each division to four of his chief students, his disciples. And in this way the disciplic succession started, and they gave it to their students, and then onwards to their students. So this is the task that Vyasadeva did. His guru was Narad Muni. He had already written different types of scriptures for different types of people. There are different mentalities that people have, you see. All are not the same. So when he gave spiritual understanding of how to make advancement in spiritual life, Vyasadeva was so perceptive that he understood that if I write just one type of spiritual book, which is very philosophical, very high and advanced in understanding, most people will not understand it. So I must also present this knowledge in such a way that even ordinary people will be able to have access to it, and then they will advance gradually. There are many people who want spiritual knowledge in a very pure form. There are others who may want it in mixed form. There are others who may say, well, I don't want spiritual life so much. I want to enjoy life in this world. But I want to use religion for the sake of promoting my material advancement in life. So Vyasadeva was so broad-minded, he had literature for all these different types of people. That is why there is so much variety in the Vedic scriptures. Now you may have had somebody asking you this question, or perhaps this question arose in your mind too. In so many religions, you just have one book. You have the Bible, you have the Quran, or you have some other book, the Old Testament. Here we have so many books and it becomes so confusing. So what is the reason for that? Why didn't God make it simpler for us and just give us one book and say, okay, you just do this one book? And now because we have all this multiplicity of books, we get so confused. First of all, there are so many books, we won't have the time to read all of them. Even if we have the time, we don't have the language skill to understand it. Even if we have the language skill, the matters are so complicated, and sometimes there are apparent contradictions between the different scriptures, we will not be able to reconcile it, and we will simply get confused. So Vyasadeva, he wrote many of these scriptures. He divided the Vedas into three categories. One was called Karma Kanda. Kanda means a section. Karma Kanda is that section of the Vedas which deals with rituals and processes by which one can live in this world and enjoy some material happiness in a religious way, in a pious way. So if somebody wants money, instead of going and cheating or robbing a bank or something like that, then they will follow some religious process to get more money. So in this way, he had a whole series of books that were devoted to this, because there would be people of that mentality. He should give people only the option: you either surrender to God and renounce everything, or there's no scope for you. Most of the world would have been left out. So that was the purpose why he made arrangement for such scriptures. The other category is for those who are very philosophically inclined, who were not inclined towards trying to enjoy this world and make material progress. So that was called Jnana Kanda. So the Karma Kanda scriptures include many, many books. And the Jnana Kanda section includes the Upanishads and some others. So these are very philosophical books, not easy for everybody to understand. The sages, they would reflect on these things. And finally, there is the Upasana Kanda, where he gives us scriptures pertaining to developing our bhakti, or love for the Supreme Lord. So he divided it to this, but mostly he had worked on the Karma Kanda. So one day, as Vyasadeva was sitting in his ashram, his guru, the great saint Narada, approached him. You all heard the name of Narad Muni. He is a great and exalted devotee. Unfortunately, in popular depiction, he is seen as a person who always instigates people, creates some dissension amongst people, goes here and says one thing, goes there, says another thing, and makes people fight. That is the way he is popularly depicted. But actually, he is a great saint, a great devotee. And whenever he does things that may appear a little strange or funny, we should know that he is doing it because he has a higher plan. Because the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna has a plan, and he uses great saints like Narad Muni to put his plans into effect. So Narad Muni one time came to the ashram of Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva was very happy to receive him. He said, "Please come, my dear Guru, Gurudev, please sit. How can I serve you? I'm very honored that you have come." So after exchanging pleasantries for some time, then Narad Muni said, "Oh my dear sage," addressing his disciple Vyasadeva, "you have written so many scriptures, but you have misled the people because you haven't really given them something that is genuinely devotional and spiritual. You have given them so many books of Karma Kanda, and you have encouraged them in their worldly life, in their materialistic pursuits. So people will think that this is what spiritual life is. Therefore, you must write some books that are exclusively dedicated only to God and to His messages, His activities, His great devotees. Speak about Lord Hari, Lord Krishna, His different avatars, how they appeared on the earth, what they did, and so on." So Vyasadeva, with great humility, although he was such a powerful sage, so brilliant, etc., but because his guru mentioned this to him, he understood that the point his guru was making was very valid. So he bowed his head, folded his hands, and accepted that instruction with all his heart. And then he composed the great book, the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Purana, which contains the essence of all the Vedic literature. It is the essence of the Vedanta Sutra. So one who understands the Srimad Bhagavatam or the Bhagavat Purana can make his or her life perfect. Now before that, there was another incident, and many of you may have heard of this from your childhood. When the time came for Vyasadeva to write down these Vedic literatures that he had composed, he was looking for some stenographer, because there were no dictaphones in those days, no recording instruments, so someone had to write down. So he was intending to dictate and somebody would write. So who is intelligent enough, who is capable enough to write so fast as he would explain? He would go on speaking, and we needed a person who would write very fast and accurately. So then Vyasadeva thought of Lord Ganesh. So he approached Lord Ganesh and said, "Would you like to do this seva?" And Ganesh said, "I'd be very honored to do it." But Ganesh had a mischievous twinkle in his eye. And he said, "I will do it, but on one condition." So Vyasadeva said, "All right, it's going to be a big job, and you've agreed to do it, that's fine. So what is your condition?" He said, "My condition is that if you stop dictating, I will stop writing. So I will only write if you dictate continuously without stopping." In other words, Ganesh said, "Once you stop writing, I will not stop dictating. After that, I will not write anymore." So Vyasadeva said, "That is a tough condition, because when you're dictating, there are times when you have to pause to think, what should I say next? So when you're giving a lecture, also you have to think, but it is a short time, it is 45 minutes, 1 hour, maybe 2 hours. But when you're going to dictate the entire Vedic literature, it is going to take days and days and weeks maybe, and months, who knows?" So Vyasadeva then thought, Ganesh is trying to trick me. But Vyasadeva was also very intelligent. He said, "I accept your condition, but I also have one condition. And that condition is that you should not write down anything till you have understood it." So Ganesh was very intelligent also. He said, "All right, accept. Fair and square, two conditions, mutual conditions have been placed." So then Vyasadeva started dictating. And he spoke and spoke. And there were times when he felt the need to pause, to reflect, to think on how he should organize the subject, etc. Then what he would do was, he would suddenly compose a very difficult shloka, very difficult verse, the meaning of which was very difficult to understand. And when he spoke that verse, Ganesh would have to pause because he didn't understand it. He would need to pause to think, what does this verse mean? And by the time Ganesh understood the meaning of that verse and wrote, Vyasadeva had already now decided what he was going to speak next. So in this way, by the cooperative work of Ganesh, Lord Ganesh and Lord Vyasadeva, many of the Vedic literatures were written, the Mahabharata especially, and some others like the Puranas, the Upanishads, and therefore we have all these available today in written form. And today also the situation in our modern day age of Kali is such that even when it's in written form, it's very hard for us to remember. Many of our devotees, they complain that the moment I read something, I hear something, I forget the next minute. So that is the nature of Kali Yuga, not to worry. But we have to keep on hearing and keep on reading and keep on applying these things in our life. So Vyasadeva therefore has played a very, very important role. And because he's the compiler of the Veda, therefore this day is his birthday, is celebrated as Guru Purnima. And out of respect to him, because he is, so to speak, the originator of the Vedic knowledge as far as we are concerned, the original is of course ultimately God himself. But because he has made it available to us, we consider him the original Guru. And therefore, anyone who delivers a spiritual discourse is considered to be his representative. No one can speak authoritatively on the Vedic knowledge unless that person is a bona fide representative of Vyasadeva. One who has studied, understood and assimilated the teachings is one who can present it. And so much so that the very seat on which such a speaker sits is called a Vyasasan. Asan means a seat, Vyas means Vyasadeva, the editor or compiler of the Vedas. So the moment any place is made, whether it's a chair or it's something like this to sit on. One who speaks always should reflect. I'm supposed to be a representative of Vedavyas. Therefore, I should not just speak anything at random. I cannot just speak whatever I want to speak. I have to speak something that is in accordance with Vedic knowledge. I cannot speculate. I cannot concoct. I cannot give my own philosophy. I have to give Vyasadeva's philosophy. Or rather, the philosophy of the Vedas, as has been delivered to us by Vyasadeva and by so many other great sages coming down in history. So from Vyasadeva, there have been many, many great personalities who are gurus. Those gurus have had their gurus. One can become a guru only because one has had a guru. No one can be a guru without having had a guru himself. So one gets knowledge from a guru, one receives it, one applies it in one's life, one reaches a certain level of appreciation and assimilation and realization of that knowledge, and then one transmits this knowledge further down. So this is called the Guru-Shishya Parampara, the disciplic succession. So it is important for us also on the day of Guru Purnima to reflect on what does it mean to be a guru. And equally, the second question, what does it mean to be a disciple? Because many times people ask the question, the first question, what does it mean to be a guru? But they hardly ever ask, what does it mean to be a disciple? The question, how do I know somebody is a genuine guru, is a very valid question, an important question. But what is the qualification of a disciple is also a very important question. So let us briefly try to consider these points. It's a very big topic, but let's try to summarize it. You see, in the Vedic scriptures, it is explained that the goal of human life is to realize God, to realize ourselves and what our relationship with God is. And this is possible through the means of dharma, which is described in our scriptures. So this is the basic difference between humans and animals, that we can understand this path of dharma, we can follow, we can look for some higher knowledge and truth, etc. So this is the purpose of human existence. Human existence is not simply for enjoying this world. It is not simply for eating well, sleeping well, mating well, defending well, having a good house, having good facilities and luxuries, having some name and fame and prestige in the society. These are not things for which the human life was intended. Human life is intended for attaining spiritual perfection, because it is the only species in which we can have such discussions. Can you imagine birds or cats or dogs sitting like this and having a discussion? No. But human beings can do it. So when human beings apply their mind and gain spiritual knowledge, then they will understand, what is the purpose of my existence? Why do I exist? What is the goal of my life? What is the perfection of my life? Is the perfection of my life to become a millionaire? Is it to become a very famous person? So we must ask these questions. So athato brahma jigyasa. So this spiritual inquiry must happen in human life. And whom do we inquire from? We inquire from a guru. We inquire from one who already has that understanding and that knowledge. One time I was speaking to a group of students in another country, and one of them was a medical student. And he said, I've heard your lecture, but why do I need to hear from another person about spiritual knowledge? Why do I need to have knowledge from a book? I think that what is important is what I feel. I don't need to hear from somebody else about how to attain spiritual knowledge, who is God, etc., etc. And I don't need any other book. Why should I follow any book? Because after all, a book is also somebody else's writing or composition. So I asked him, you know, you are studying medicine. you want to be a surgeon. Now, can I say, I want to be a surgeon, I don't want to hear from any professor. I don't want to read any medical book. I will do surgery according to the way I like. Is that possible? He said, definitely no. I said, definitely yes. So in any field of knowledge, nobody will accept you as a bona fide representative of that field of knowledge or a profession unless you have been trained under someone who's already expert in that field, unless you have read books in that field, you have passed examinations, you have got practical knowledge also. So in any field of human endeavor, whether it is medicine and surgery, accountancy, economics, engineering, any field of human knowledge, we need a teacher and we need textbooks. So I said, in every branch of knowledge in this world, you are willing to learn from somebody. So why only when it comes to spiritual knowledge do you say, I don't want to hear from anybody? Then I will decide whatever it is according to my imagination. The same argument will not work when it comes to becoming a surgeon. You cannot say, I will operate the way I like. No, there are standard procedures. There is a whole book of knowledge, or many books, that will teach you how to do that. So therefore, the argument that I will do whatever I like, that I will think whatever is right for me and I will do that and that is the truth according to me, I said is not a valid assumption. Because in every field of human endeavor, we have a teacher and we have some books. So why should this principle not apply to spiritual knowledge? All the more because spiritual knowledge is difficult. It is beyond our senses. It cannot be obtained simply by just speculating about something. And also because spiritual knowledge is the most important knowledge amongst all the different subjects that are available. So therefore, the need for someone who will explain this knowledge to us is very important. We cannot just go to anybody and everybody. So now the question comes, how do we understand who is a genuine guru? The first and most important principle is that that person must have received knowledge from another person who is a bona fide guru. So how do I know the previous one is a bona fide guru? He must have obtained knowledge properly from another bona fide guru. So how do I know that person is a bona fide guru? He should have also accepted from another bona fide guru. And you keep going back and back and back and back till you come to God Himself. So with Vyasadeva, his guru was Narada. And Narada's guru was his own father, Brahma. And Brahma, who is the creator of the universe, his guru is none other than Lord Krishna Himself. So all Vedic knowledge or all knowledge ultimately starts from God. So in that sense, He is the original Guru. And all others, including Vyasadeva, are ultimately His representatives. So Lord Krishna empowers a certain personality to be the Guru for the age by compiling the Vedic scriptures like Vyasadeva. So this is the first and most important requirement, that the guru must come in a line of bona fide gurus that originates from the Supreme Lord Himself. That is the very first test to which you can put a guru. What are your antecedents, sir? Where have you gained this knowledge from? And we may say, why? How should that be done? Well, it's just like a doctor. If you want to go to any doctor, won't you like to know whether he's a qualified FRCP, MRCP, MD, whatever it is? You would like to know. If you go to some doctor and there is no nameplate, no description of the qualifications, and you know, I just learned through internet and I can operate very nicely. I've learned surgical skills on the internet, then you'll say, no, no, I better not go to you. You look for where that person has learned from, which college, which university, Ah, he's done such and such degree from such and such university. Okay, so I think he's a genuine person. So the bona fides of the teacher must be established first before we consider anything else. So once we have established that there is a bona fide disciplic line from which that person has accepted knowledge, then we consider that person's individual qualifications. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a nice verse which says, Tasma Gurum Prabhadyeta Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam Shate Parishnishnatam Brahman Nipashamashrayam. In this verse it is said, because you have a human form of life, now you should approach a bona fide spiritual master, Gurum Prabhadyeta. Go and surrender to such a bona fide guru. Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam. And herein is the qualification of a disciple also. You must go and surrender to a guru. And you must be jigyasu. Jigyasu means that you must be inquisitive. Inquisitive about what? Inquisitive about Shreya Uttamam. Shreya means welfare. Uttamam means topmost. So Shreya Uttamam means the highest welfare for all of us, which is spiritual knowledge. So one should be inquisitive, seriously inquisitive about spiritual matters. Then one can be qualified to approach a guru. So the first qualification of a disciple also is that the disciple should be very eager and inquisitive to learn spiritual knowledge. Otherwise, it will become a very casual affair. One should certainly not go to the spiritual master seeking some material blessings, looking how will my material advancement happen by going to such and such spiritual master. If I get his blessings and I will do well in my profession, or perhaps I will earn more money, etc., etc. So that is not the approach of a disciple. There may be many gurus who may encourage the materialistic tendency in their disciples, but that is not an ideal combination. Actually, in the scriptures it is mentioned that there are different guru-disciple combinations. One combination of disciple is when the disciple is very materialistic, guru is also very materialistic. So both are happy. The guru gets a lot of donations, he's happy. The disciples get some, you know, a facility for improving their material condition, so they're happy. But even though they're satisfied with each other, but spiritually they don't make much progress. So it's not really a good combination. The other is when the guru is materialistic, but the disciple is very spiritual. And the spiritual seeker thinks, I've come here seeking spiritual knowledge and he's only telling me how to get more money, how to do this and that. I don't want that. So both are unhappy. The other combination is when the guru is very spiritual but the seekers come to him asking for material benefits. So the guru is frustrated, the disciples are also frustrated. The ideal combination of a guru and disciple is when both are very sincere for spiritual advancement. The guru has to be well realized in spiritual life, knowledge and conclusions, and the disciple must be a very sincere and eager aspirant for spiritual knowledge. So we have excellent combinations like Arjun and Krishna. Krishna is the perfect guru. Arjuna is the perfect disciple. Then you have Shukadev Goswami, who spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam to King Parikshit. Perfect guru, perfect disciple. There are any number of instances in the Srimad Bhagavatam and all over the Vedic literature that give us examples of perfect combinations of spiritual master and disciple. Unless this combination is perfect, unless both the disciple and the guru are bona fide, the result will not be very auspicious. So in as much as it is important to know the qualifications of a guru, it is also important to know the qualifications of a disciple. So the disciple must be Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam, must be very inquisitive to gather spiritual knowledge. And therefore one should approach a bona fide spiritual master and surrender to him. And what are the qualifications of the spiritual master? Shabde Parechana Shnatam Brahmanyapashamashrayam. The spiritual master must be very well versed in the Vedic teachings. The spiritual master must be aware of what the teachings of the scriptures are, especially the conclusions, the essential points. And the spiritual master should have realized them within his heart. He should not have only book knowledge, but he should also have realized knowledge. And therefore he should be a great devotee, a powerful devotee of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. He should also have controlled his mind, controlled his senses, and he should not speak anything that is outside of the Vedic literature. As I mentioned earlier, he should not concoct anything. So whatever the guru speaks must be in accordance with what the previous gurus have spoken and in accordance with what the scriptures or the Vedic literature say. So we have a tripod. We have a check and balance system. Suppose you hear somebody saying something and somebody says, this is a guru, then you have a way to check. Is this person saying something that is authorized by the bona fide gurus in the past? What he's saying, does it match up to what is said in the scriptures? So we have this threefold test: guru, sadhu, shastra. Guru means the spiritual master, sadhu means the previous gurus, and maybe other contemporary gurus as well, but especially the previous gurus. And shastra means the Vedic literature. You know, now when you drive a car, you have your GPS, isn't it? So it tells you the direction. It tells you whether you're moving right or wrong. And you will have one lady who will quite sternly tell you that you have to go left or you have to go right, you have to do certain things, stop the car here. And she will not stop till you have reached your destination. So even for ordinary navigation, to know whether we are going in the right destination or not, we need a GPS. So also in spiritual life, we need not a GPS, but we need a GSS, Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. Yes? So this will help us to navigate the turbulent waters of this ocean of material existence. Then we will understand what to do, how to live, how not to live, what is real knowledge, what is the goal of our life, how should we try to achieve it, who am I, who is God, what is my relationship with God, what is this world, what is my relationship with this world, etc. There are many fundamental questions that come about, and the guru will answer this on the basis of sadhu and shastra. So one must go to such a spiritual master and surrender. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Tadviddhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshyanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshinaha. Lord Krishna says, therefore, one must approach a bona fide spiritual master who is a tattva darshi. Tattva means truth, darshi means one who sees. So one must approach a person who has seen or realized the truth. And what should one do? Tadviddhi pranipatena. One should surrender to such a person. Then pariprashnena. One should ask questions. But what kind of questions? Spiritual questions. Sevaya. One should render seva to that personality. And by doing these things, by surrendering, which means to follow his instructions for our life, Second, asking spiritual questions or questions in regard to application of spiritual knowledge to our day-to-day life, and submissively hearing the answers. And third, actually rendering service to the Guru, one will become oneself, self-realized in course of time. So that is a perfect disciple-guru combination. One time there was a young man who approached a guru, a sadhu, and he had many questions to ask. But the sadhu noticed that every time he tried to answer the question, before he had even completed the answer, the young man would interrupt and say, no, but I don't agree, but I think, and in my opinion, etc., etc. So this went on for some time. Finally, the sadhu realized that this was not getting anywhere. So then he said, okay, never mind, young man, let's just halt the discussion. Why don't you have some refreshments? I'll get you some fresh hot milk. Let's relax for some time and refresh. So he bought him a cup and he had some fresh hot milk and he started pouring the milk into the cup. And the level of the milk in the cup was rising and rising and rising, and it came to near the top. And then the young man put his hand on top of the cup to say, that's enough. But the sadhu went on pouring, continued pouring the milk. And finally the young man blurted out, don't you see my cup is full, you're still pouring? So then the sadhu replied, he said, my son, that is your problem. Your cup is already full. You already think you know everything. So you come before me, you ask me questions, but you're not willing, not patient enough to hear my answers. You already, your mind is so full of your own opinions and your own thoughts. You just want to tell me what is the truth rather than listening to me. So that is not the right approach also. You've all heard that little anecdote about a student going to a music teacher to learn the flute, and the music teacher asks the student, do you know how to play the flute? And the student says, yeah, I've been playing for some years. Okay, so the charge for you is, let us say, 20 pounds. And then his other friend is there as well. Friend says, I also want to learn the flute. Fine, very good. So have you learned playing the flute before? Have you ever played it before? He said, no, I have no idea how to play the flute. I don't have a clue. Okay, the fee for you would be 10 pounds. So the first student said, that's strange. I know how to play the flute. So you're charging me 20 pounds. And my friend, he has no clue what flute playing is all about. And you're going to charge him only 10 pounds. You should be charging him more. So the music teacher replied that actually I have to work harder on you because he's a clean slate. So I tell him and he understands it and he will follow it. But for you, my work is harder because you think you already know quite a lot. So I'll have to make you unlearn what you've learned and then I will have to teach you. So double work for me, so double fees. So in this way, the receptivity of the disciple is also very important. So for a guru, we have all these different qualities, and for a disciple as well. And we should all try to become very sincere aspirants of the spiritual path and seek out a bona fide spiritual master. How will one get one? How will one be able to get a bona fide spiritual master? For one thing, we should have some knowledge. You see, if you want to buy gold and you go into the marketplace, you must have some knowledge of what gold looks like. Or you may come away with some iron or some other metal. I remember when I was in our temple in Vrindavan, we had some strange person walking into our temple. You know, we have people of different natures and kinds, isn't it? In this world, many different types of people exist. So this one person came to see me and he had this block of what seemed to be gold. And he said that I was excavating my house, repairing it, and some digging was going on, and I found this block And since yours is a temple, you're nice holy people, so I'm willing to sell it to you at a very discounted price. So I immediately smelt a rat because it doesn't look so straightforward. I'm not an expert jeweler, I have no idea of gold, but I decided I would get an opinion, but his story didn't seem to ring true. And so I said, well, let me first check it. He said, no, I can't give the gold to you. No, unless you give me the gold, I can't say anything, because first of all, it has to be legal. If it's not legal, we have nothing to do with this gold. Because when it's an archaeological thing, there are government procedures, regulations. As a temple, we cannot get involved in all of this. But even otherwise, if all of that is clear that you want to just give it to us as a donation or something so that we can use it, it's okay, but I must understand the genuineness of this gold. And then he went away with it and didn't come back. Because obviously it was not genuine gold. It just looked like gold. So we must have either knowledge of what constitutes real gold, or we must have access to someone who is an expert. So similarly, when we go out to look for spiritual knowledge, we should have some understanding of what a guru is, even if it's not very much, just something. And then we go into the company of those who have a deeper understanding of that. We come to the association of devotees of God, of sincere spiritual seekers. And then we have some doubts. How do I know? What should I be doing? What should I not be doing? What should I be looking for, etc.? Then one's understanding becomes a little evolved. Then one gets more knowledge. And in this way, it becomes easier for one to discern and understand who is a guru, what is a guru, what is spiritual life. One gets some basic conceptual understanding of spiritual knowledge. And then ultimately, of course, it is a question of our sincere prayers to Lord Krishna. The Guru is a representative of Lord Krishna. The Guru is not Lord Krishna. The Guru is not God. This is also a mistake many people make. They either consider their Gurus to be God, or the Guru himself may proclaim that I am God. Or when his disciples proclaim him to be God, he keeps quiet. There is a statement in English, in Sanskrit, that says, Maunam Sammati Lakshanam, which means silence is an indication of assent or agreement. So for example, if somebody comes to me and says, you are God, and I don't protest, it means I agree. That means I'm saying, yes, you are right, I am God. So, we must be very careful to see that the Guru is a human being, but he is spiritually evolved human being. Not an ordinary materialistic human being, but he is a very spiritually evolved human being, but at the same time, he is not God. We should not put him on the same platform as God, although, because he is a representative of God, we will treat him with that kind of respect. But with also the knowledge that he is a representative, he is not directly God himself. So then gradually, as we move on, we will get a deeper understanding, and by the Lord's arrangement, he will arrange the meeting of the disciple and the guru. This is a transcendental divine arrangement. It doesn't happen by chance. It is divinely ordained. So if a sincere spiritual seeker prays intensely to the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna, then Lord Krishna will make arrangements. By the mercy of God, one gets a guru. By the mercy of guru, one gets God. In this way, one can make one's life perfect. The subject matter is big. I think I have exceeded my time limit. So I will stop here. We have talked about Chaturmasya, we have spoken about Guru Purnima, we spoke about Vyasadev and his great contributions to the society, we have spoken about the Guru and the disciple, and I think this is enough for one day. For those of you who wish to make further advancement on this path, then I would urge all of you to please do that. There is wonderful facility available, and we hope that we will be able to have more programs here, similar programs from time to time. Mr. Sanjay Gadhi has taken a lot of initiative to arrange this program. It was his idea, and I was very happy to oblige and participate in this program. So I think we must thank Mr. Sanjay Gadhi for having taken the trouble to arrange this program at rather short notice. And he's also keen that he wants to continue having such programs over here. So I would request all of you to please take advantage of this opportunity. And also I want to thank all of you once again for having come here today on this evening. Today is a lunar eclipse. What time is it now? 9 o'clock. Oh my God, I went too far. The lunar eclipse has already started. I think 8:30 or something is the penumbra, partial eclipse, and after some time there is a total eclipse as far as London is concerned. So during eclipses it is said that one must engage in spiritual activities intensely. So you are just right, we are here at the time of the lunar eclipse, and we are speaking about Lord Krishna's message about spiritual knowledge. So it's the perfect setting, perfect way to spend your time in an eclipse. So a very nice coincidence has happened. So thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Do we have time for questions, or is it too late? Yes? Okay.
Can I ask?
Sure, sure.
It is a little more general rather than the topic we covered today. A lot of the time people feel in their lives, you know, I've been good, I've been going to temples on and off, or I've been doing charity and so on. And something happened, you know, going through life for 10, 15, 20 years, and say some accident happens or some illness happens, some loss happens. And that's when people's faith is really shaken. It's like, why me? Why this? What have I done to deserve this? Can you throw some light from a spiritual perspective on this?
Okay, thank you. That's an important question. That in life we often have to face adverse circumstances. There may be losses, pain, tragedies, etc., that may happen, and it is natural that people question, why has it happened to me? Why has this happened at all? So how should one understand this? Of course, one needs to acquire spiritual knowledge. That is a fundamental point. When one understands spiritual knowledge, then things begin to fall in place. The more we understand the Bhagavad Gita, the more these things will fall in place. So we understand the law of karma. We understand the nature of punarjanma, life after life. We understand the philosophy of the soul and the body. We understand the nature of this material world. What is destiny? What is fate? What is happiness? What is not happiness? So in order to answer that question and to be satisfied, one must acquire knowledge. Knowledge is the key to getting relief from misery or from confusion. At the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Arjuna was baffled. He was thoroughly confused, but he was fortunate enough to have the perfect spiritual master, Lord Krishna, with him. So his confusions were dispelled. His doubts were dispelled. So similarly, when we gain spiritual knowledge, our conviction and understanding increases, and we are able to understand, at least broadly, why certain things are happening to us. We may not be able to pinpoint the specific cause of a specific problem, but we can overall understand the general scheme of things and how the world operates. And therefore we will not become bewildered. And rather it will strengthen our faith in the spiritual process. It will give us a deeper realization and understanding of what life is all about. And we will go deeper into the Bhagavad Gita and try to understand more and more. And when we chant the holy names of the Lord and we participate in this devotional process, our capacity to absorb adversities and tragedies will also be enhanced very significantly. We will be able to cope with all the problems effectively. Okay?
I don't know if anybody else has a question. Go on, Desha.
Yes.
Thank you for a lovely class. I have two questions.
Yes.
One is a basic question. Is there a reason that I thought Dwapara was two, so Dwapara comes before Treta? Is there a reason that it switched? We have Treta and then Dwapara?
Jen, your question is that what is the sequence of yugas and does it change? Generally, the sequence is Satya, Treta, Dwapar, Kali, and that is how it is maintained throughout. And this time also it was like that. So that is a normal sequence.
And the other question was around just what you were saying about karma. How do we apply that to something like organ donation? So, say if somebody passes away and they register as an organ donor, you think you're doing something good because you're donating an organ to someone, but if you're leaving part of the material body behind, does the soul latch onto that? And do you incur the karma from the person who's dying for the person who's taking it?
Okay, so your question is about organ donations and what are the implications in terms of karma, etc.? It's a bit of a delicate question. Generally, the principle is whatever you give in charity, you get some reaction for that also. If you give to a person who is, let us say, an alcoholic, and you give him money, he spends that money for drinking alcohol, you also partake of that karma to some degree. Because you have given him that money and he's not a qualified person to receive your charity. You give it to someone who uses it for Lord Krishna's purposes, exclusively for spiritual purposes, not for any material or anyone's private personal purpose. Then you also get tremendous spiritual benefit by that. So charity has its consequences on the donor as well. So when you donate an organ, so naturally the principle will continue to apply. You're, instead of giving some money, you're giving a part of your body. That's also your property. So it depends on who the recipient of that donor is. If the recipient of that donor is someone who is very spiritually advanced, you get great benefit by doing it. But generally, it doesn't work like that. Generally, you just, unless there's an emergency where you give a specific patient and some relative donates a part of the liver or something like that, or for blood, which is the most common thing, when you give blood, it goes to the blood bank and your patient there gets somebody else's blood. Therefore, there are some religious groups, even among Christians, there's some particular group, I don't know which one, which they don't do blood transfusions. They don't accept blood donations. They have their own reasons for that. So this is a delicate topic because it is so common nowadays. And for maintaining somebody's life, you know, so all right, if that has to be done, fine. But one should know that there are karmic consequences. You know, so one should do it with this understanding. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was a really good session, especially learning about the Vyasa Muni and all the youth, and especially the story about the Krishna and Arjun as well. Just I would like to put a comment somewhere. When we were talking about Guru and Shishya, the relationship, somewhere, I might not be right what I'm getting, but somewhere I felt that Guru knows everything and Shishya knows nothing. And then, like, as example, when you gave example of the guy who went for the flute and he said, I know something, and then Guru said, I need to do unlearn and stuff like that. Other side perception, the person might have known something and then Guru might have learned from him. So rather than one way direction, what I feel, if it's bi-directional, then the goal will be achieved very quickly for that person.
The question is that instead of the knowledge flowing from the Guru to the disciple and having a unidirectional flow, what if we have a bi-directional flow, that the Guru also gets some knowledge from the disciple? Yes?
Yeah, why not? I feel if there is really genuine conversation going on.
Okay. You see, it depends on what field you're talking. Let's say there's a medical professor of surgery, 50 years experience, 30 years experience, and there's someone who's just doing an MBBS. Studying. Now obviously there's no possibility of that new student teaching the experienced surgeon something, but what the surgeon can learn from the disciple or the student is maybe something else that is not connected with his field. Say there's the student has a background in accountancy or economics, he can learn, that's all right. But you see, in spiritual matters this doesn't work. The whole process works because it is downward moving from a superior source to a subordinate source. It cannot be the reverse. You cannot mix up the positions of guru and disciple and interchange them. In very, very, very rare cases, it may happen that the reverse flows when the disciple becomes so advanced and exceptional that he can even deliver his guru. Yes, but these are very, very rare situations. Generally, the principle is to maintain that unidirectional flow. Otherwise, it will be a chaotic situation. Because the guru is supposed to be one who has realization of that spiritual knowledge. The disciple is coming to learn. The disciple, the whole process of learning is from a superior source. It is not from a speculative approach. It's not that the disciple with his or her meager knowledge can say, well, I think I know better than my guru. Then one deprives oneself of the possibility of receiving that knowledge. Like that, you know, the young man whose cup was full. Yes? So the disciple has to be like a clean slate and takes on the spiritual knowledge. When it comes to practical things of life, that's a different matter. But still the guru should be consulted about how to apply the spiritual knowledge when it comes to practical matters of life. So it will be very counterproductive. It will make the whole process meaningless if the disciple starts teaching the guru. Then that will not work. This exchange of information at an everyday level, that's fine. Or at a level of philosophical discussion, that's fine. But when it comes to teaching, no, there is only one direction. It has to be from the guru to the disciple and not the other way around. Then the process doesn't work. Yes? Yes.
Apologies for not attending the seminar from the beginning. My question is, maybe on behalf of some of the audience today, is can you progress in spiritual life without a guru, despite the fact that, you know, you're still maybe chanting Hare Krishna, maybe you're reading the Bhagavad Gita, you're doing service on Krishna Janmashtami, or any type of service, but you might not be fortunate enough to have made contact with the Guru. So can you progress without a Guru?
Your question is, can we progress without a Guru? And you mentioned a hypothetical case where somebody is already indulging in spiritual practices properly. So if that person is properly doing some spiritual practices, he or she must have heard it from someone and somewhere. Yes? So that person has already got some kind of gurus. They may be very preliminary gurus, but some kind of shiksha or instruction has been received. So through that shiksha, they have got connected to the broad parampara, the disciplic succession. They may not have identified any particular person to whom they want to surrender themselves completely or to whom they can link themselves up in that way, but they are within the broad umbrella of that shelter. So they are moving ahead, and in course of time, by the Lord's arrangement, something will happen. Okay? Alright, so thank you very much. You've all been a very, very attentive audience. And I wish and pray that all of us sitting here in this room will be able to make very nice advancement in our spiritual life. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.